Good morning, you're on TalkBack.
Good morning again.
Good morning.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for taking my call. I do have some things written down, and I'm just hopefully if I can get a few things covered here. I've got some questions, and you'll be patient. Why do you think that this new jail is so much better that we need to take more from the taxpayers, you know, with the force of government threatening to steal people's homes like Mr. Foote up in Marlow if they don't pay? Also considering that you already have said that 50% of the caged human beings don't belong there and that it will not be profitable for the county. Also, who are the people who do benefit not only from the caging of these human beings, but also that neither jail is reported and no jail has ever been reported to be profitable?
The first thing I'd like to correct is when I said that 50% of the people don't belong there, let me correct what I said the last time that I was on Cynthia's show. I said if we look at the annual report for the New Hampshire State Prison, the number one admission category for that particular year, which I think was 2008, if I'm not mistaken, was probation and parole violations. And the number two category was nonviolent drug offenses. Both of those categories added together were 47%, which suggests that almost 50% of the people who are admitted to the New Hampshire State Prison in that given year were done so for nonviolent crimes. That's just to clarify the record of what I said. There's another periodical that says if you were to look at all of the jails across the United States, meaning the local jails, the state prisons, and everything else, and you were to do a risk assessment, and I can't remember the periodical that did this study. This was probably about 2003 that I read this. They estimated at the time that 40% of the people who were incarcerated were not a risk of flight or violence and therefore did not need to be locked up. Now, what's interesting to me is that we get to this economic crisis in the United States where every state and every municipality is looking to put their budget together. And in looking at the budget, they realize suddenly that they have built and designed a correctional system on a state level that they can no longer sustain. And now we have to revisit who should be in prison. Who should be in a local jail, and what does it cost to have people in jail? My opinion is, and I think that most responsible Americans would agree, that you have to have a Department of Corrections in society. There is a certain percentage of people who are going to commit crimes. They are going to be a threat of violence or harm and a risk to public safety, and there needs to be a place for them to go. The argument is and remains, is everybody that goes to jail, do they necessarily need to be in jail? Or are there some alternative methods? And this is really a good lead-in, if I can continue, Cynthia, on how this whole project came to be. Because we hired consultants early on, and I'm talking about 1999 or so. Mm-hmm. It was 1996 when I first brought to the county commissioners the fact that our jail is increasing a crowded situation and inhumane conditions. And part of my responsibility when I was hired in 1993 was to help the lawsuits go away. So I was watching the trend as we were going, and we were going up by 10 an average. Our average daily population was going up by 10 every 12 months. And I said, at this rate, we're going to be in a real fix real soon. So 1996 was the first year that I floated the idea of building either an addition or a new Department of Corrections. And the story goes, we spent the next decade studying why we don't need this jail or shouldn't get a jail. To fuel the debate of do we need it or do we not need it. But here's the one thing that we learned from hiring these consultants that we did, who said that the current trend, the current increase in the criminal justice demographic suggests that the population in the year 2010 for the county jail would be 210 inmates per day. And there's no way that the existing building in Westmoreland could accommodate that.
That's made to handle how many?
It was built to handle 47. This morning I called out there, I've got the number here somewhere, we had a population of, let me look it up. We had the maximum number of people that we've had in that jail was 132 at one time, if mm-hmm. you can believe that. This morning, when I called out there, we had 128, and that building was designed for 47. So these consultants said there are a lot of things that the criminal justice system has to do if you're going to avoid an average daily population of 210 people in the year 2010. One of those was to take a look at the mentally ill who were incarcerated and perhaps start a mental health court. We did that. Start an alternative sentencing program. We did that. Start a program whereby people could be on pretrial detention in the community. We're starting to do that. Use electronic monitoring, which is something that I've been pushing since the 90s. We're doing that. So all of these things that we've tried to do, in one respect, helps keep more people out of jail. Unfortunately, the other thing it does is widen the net on the criminal justice system and increase the amount of social control in the system.
357-1290. Good morning. You're on TalkBack.
Yes, I was just feeling that statistics can be so misleading. You're saying that the largest population of people incarcerated are parole violations, and that's a non-violent offense. But could some of those parole violators be child molesters, be armed robbers, and be violent?
The answer is yes, they could, but the evidence is no, they're not. There's a New Hampshire, the county and the state are cooperating with the Justice Reinvestment Council, and this is from the Council of State Governments Justice Center, and they're doing a study this year about why people are going back to jail. And this is also evidenced by national studies, too, that the majority of the people that are violated for parole or probation are for nonviolent crimes. This explains why we build jail beds at the rate in the United States of about 900 every 2 weeks. We've sustained that rate for the last 20 years, but yet violent crime is at a 30-year low. And in fact, in New Hampshire, crime is down. In every state across the nation, crime is down. Violent crime is down, but the demand for bed space increases. And the reason for that is you have longer sentencing. People have to stay longer. We're staying twice as long in jail today than we were for the same crimes in the 70s. And when you look at, I'm looking for a statistic here that I can give you from the Council of State Governments Justice Center. It says the total recidivism rate, people that go back to jail in New Hampshire within 3 years, is 51%. 37% of those were drug offenders. It also said that probation revocations will cost the state $11.4 million and counties another $5.7 million. So here again, what I said is that jurisdictions across the country are looking at these statistics and saying if a person is violated for probation or parole, is it for a violent act where they need to be taken out of the community, or is it something where they can remain in the community on a different kind of sanction?
Good morning, you're on TalkBack.
Good morning, Rick and Cynthia.
Good morning.
I've got probably 50 questions, and I'm not sure that Mr. Van Wickler could answer all of them.
So we'll try for three.
That's what I'm going to try to do, and only things that I think he would know the answers to.
Okay.
Now, sir, what is going to be the difference in cost of unhousing a prisoner in the new jail versus the old jail?
Well, this is a formula where I'm going to give you two ways to approach this. Okay, the first is my way to approach it, which is the easy way, and that would be the cost that the county incurs for operating that particular Department of Corrections minus the revenues divided into the average daily population would equate to your cost per day, which then you could then multiply by 365 to get your annual costs.
Okay.
Now, that's my way of doing it. That's a simple way. It's, you know, I think the best approach. Now, there's a federal government way to determine what the cost per day would be. It is much more lengthy, involves a great deal more work. And that answer is that it came out for us to be about $114 per day. That absorbs the operating costs, the payment of the bond, everything that we have to do. Using the federal government's formula, it comes out to about that rate. Now, currently in Westmoreland, we are able to charge as much as $64 per day.
Okay.
Now, there's no bond, obviously, with the building in Westmoreland, but what we're able to do is take all of our operating costs, and there's new legislation at the federal level a couple of years ago that said that local jurisdictions not only could figure their operating costs, what it costs the taxpayer, but also to add a little bit, I think it's 10% on top of that, to recover your trouble for holding federal inmates in that case.
Okay.
But specifically with regard to how much it cost us, the answer is going to be about $114 per day.
Okay, sir, and I certainly appreciate your candid, and that was pretty much what I had come up with and figured through my investigations. Now, my next question is, see, I have no objection to, prisoners from our own community and our own county. But what happens in the event, and I know the jail is built, larger than, I believe it's going to hold a couple hundred people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this excess going to be filled up with federal prisoners?
Well, first, let me give you the breakdown of how many beds there are, how many beds might be available, and then who we might put in those beds. The fact, when people say out there that the jail is overbuilt and we've built this huge jail that we don't need and it has a bunch of extra space, is blatantly false. It's simply not true. And when we were first going before our delegation to put this bond before them and this plan before them, they made it very specific that we were building a jail to accommodate the needs of Cheshire County, and that in the event we had available bed space, we would make that available to revenue-paying customers. Now, the breakdown is this. In that jail, the general population jail beds for men is 126, and the general population beds for women is 35. So these beds are beds where you could be assigned a classification level. You live in that particular bed. You have the opportunity to come and go from your cell, and you're managed in accordance with modern day corrections. This number does not include the maximum security beds where you can't move and you're restricted to your cell, or a close observation area bed. So we've got 126 for the men, 35 for the women. Earlier on the show, I reported that I called out to the jail at 6:30 this morning. Our population was 128. That's 114 males. So if I were to take today's population and put it into the brand new jail that we're not in yet, that means I have 12 beds available for the men in the general population area.
Okay.
That's not a lot.
Now, how many do you have in the high security?
In the high security area, we built a segregation unit that has some flexibility. There's 24 beds in there that you could lock down and use as a maximum security. What I mean by flexibility is we've got a couple of different ways to look at this. When you build a jail, oftentimes what happens is you're forced to do what's called value engineering. If the project goes over budget, you have to make some cuts and scale it back. And one of the things that we wanted to do is I looked at other jails and talked to other wardens around the country about jail building. The big mistake was they didn't plan for the future. Now, 10% of any project, any jail bed, 10% of the number of beds that you have need to be allocated for maximum security for administrative and punitive segregation. That's how we control human behavior. We're responsible for managing the behavior of people that society fears. And we have to manage that behavior without getting physical and hurting people to the best that we can. So we do that through a balance of incentives and disincentives. So that maximum security unit is how we control or manage, rather, the behavior of people. If they're in a general population area and they're hurting other people, stealing from other people in the jail environment, they're going to be moved to this maximum security area. So the 24 segregation beds that we have has the flexibility. Part of it can be opened to a general population unit if we need it, but it's a harder environment than the general population areas. And secondly, it serves to accommodate the needs for the future growth. We will not have to build those beds again. And the reason why that's important is because those beds are more expensive than general population beds.
Oh, I understand what you said, and I really appreciate you explaining all that. But I guess it's going to really come down to dollars and cents, because essentially we're looking at, I've actually looked at my tax bill, which I know does not include anything new on the jail, and my county portion went up 12% in 6 months. Now, and obviously I believe everything you're saying, so we're essentially almost looking at a 90% increase in what it's going to cost to incarcerate these people, which, of course, will be a huge tax impact on the people for many, many, many years to come. And see, I don't have the problem with the local people, but I do know that in the past the jail has housed federal prisoners, which I totally object to, because I look, why should my tax dollars be spent to house tax dollars, particularly when, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I do understand if it costs like $120, you bill out $120 to the federal government?
Well, let's tackle that.
Yeah.
The first thing I want to explain is how much exactly this is costing you. The jail bond for $38.5 million for the jail that's will be done here in the spring, it cost the taxpayers last year, 2009, $48 per 100,000. So if your house is valued at $100,000, it costs you $48.
Okay.
It goes down every year. So for 2000.
Wait a minute, excuse me, sir. You said $48 per 100,000.
That is correct.
Okay, yes.
So in 2010, it's $43 in change. Let's call it 44. It's $44 per 100,000, but specifically it's $43 in change. And then each year it decreases, it goes down. So that's what it's going to cost you. And the reason why I wanted to address that today is because there's been so many people calling in complaining about the size, which, you know, is not true. We didn't overbuild it. We didn't build it specifically for federal inmates. And nobody knows how much it's going to cost them. All they know is their taxes are going up, and it must be because of the jail. So what I want to explain is this is exactly what it's costing you, so that you have the facts. Now let's talk about federal inmates. Any law enforcement agency, it doesn't matter who they are. I could have a deputy sheriff from Vermont show up to the jail at 10 o'clock at night with a prisoner. I am obligated by law to take that prisoner. So if I have a law enforcement officer showing up with a legally arrested or detained person, I have to take that person and detain them. Now, the federal government has federal penitentiaries, but what they don't have are pretrial detention facilities. So we do have a federal court in Brattleboro. And so there's a Brattleboro market there for pretrial federal prisoners. And what they need to do is find a place to hold these people in a pretrial status. So they could bring them to us, A, and say, we're the federal government, we have this prisoner, you have to take them, and that would be true. And then there's B, because we know that's going to happen, how about if we have an amicable agreement where you help pay the taxpayers of Cheshire County to accommodate those inmates? So we agree by way of a contract on how much money they're going to pay us for those offenders. The current contract for holding federal inmates in Westmoreland is $64. We are currently negotiating with the federal government, the county administrator is, the director of finance is, with people in Washington to determine what the new federal rate will be, yet to be determined, for the new jail in Keene. What we do know is it will be more than $64. It will probably be up in the $100 range somewhere. And so we will charge for those 12 beds, those 12 empty beds that we have, I will seek to fill with paying customers. That money, the commissioners could then decide to apply towards the bond and pay that off more quickly than what we're scheduled to do so. If there's a medical emergency for these federal inmates, that is all paid for by the federal government. So in addition to a per diem, all the overhead associated with holding that offender is paid for. Their medications are paid for by the federal government, and their hospitalization is paid for by the federal government.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
357-1290. Good morning. You're on Talkback, and thank you for holding. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Pretty good. Hey, I only got part of the show this morning, so I just wanted to run a quick question by you guys.
Okay.
From what I heard, it sounds something like, I think his name's Mark, the warden.
Rick.
Doesn't agree with, or he thinks that at least 50% of the people in there are there for victimless crimes. And what I'm wondering is, during his studies during the 90s and early 2000s, is where did he go wrong with his numbers if by 2010 we were supposed to be housing 210 criminals a year?
Well, the unfortunate part is you started out by saying you missed part of the program,
right.
And that's too bad. Any listener that's been following us along, I'm sure can track this. These are not my numbers. So it's frustrating for me to have people continually call in to say this is what I'm saying. This is what the data suggests for the country, and in addition for the state of New Hampshire. They're not my numbers. So let's clarify that. We didn't go wrong. The answer is we're doing things right, was our point. The prediction of holding 210 people in the year 2010 could only be achieved if we did several things in our criminal justice community and were able to supervise offenders through programs that were less expensive than incarceration. That's what the county has tried to do over the last several years. They've been very successful in doing it. And one of the things that I want to advocate and keep pushing is electronic monitoring, because we have very sophisticated technology these days that allow us to put somebody on electronic monitoring. We're able to track them by means of GPS, hold them accountable for where they're supposed to be or not supposed to be, rather than paying all the money that it costs to keep them housed in a secure facility.
So, thank you very much. Good morning, you're on TalkBack.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Am I on?
You are.
Okay. About what you intend to do with Westmoreland. And because you guys are going to keep it open, aren't you? And I want to know the truth. I know you spin all these numbers, but I want to know the truth. What are you really doing with Westmoreland once it's supposedly going to close down?
Okay, I haven't spun any numbers. That's the first thing.
Well,
the second thing is the truth with respect to Westmoreland is that there is a committee of delegation members who are to look at that particular facility, what its cost of operation is, and what uses it might have. They have not decided or made any recommendations to the county commissioners yet with respect to what that institution might become or what uses it might serve. What we will do is keep in the budget, you know, enough to make sure that the pipes don't freeze and the essential things to keep it up and running by our facilities department, so that when the commissioners make a decision to recommend something to the delegation, that they will be able to do so. So the answer is nothing has been decided with respect to Westmoreland today, and that's the truth.
Okay. Thank you for calling. Good morning. You're on TalkBack.
Good morning. It's Ian with Freekeen.com. Calling back with a quick question for Rick, since I wasn't able to ask it in the first hour.
He wasn't
really on. Quick question for you. There's somebody that's been put in jail, not in Westmoreland, but out in Valley Street in Manchester. And it's a real stark contrast, from what I can tell, between the Valley Street Jail and the Cheshire County Jail. That people have always said that Valley Street is just awful, and I think Westmoreland just doesn't get the same negative reviews. One of the things
that's
they're
a good
doing
thing.
Over there, yeah,
I'm glad to hear that.
I think that within a system that has some major injustices that I think Rick himself would acknowledge, that Rick does the best that he can with the inhumane system that he's presented with. But that's not my issue. My question is, what they're doing over at Valley Street is they're claiming that they can't give out the prisoner's visiting hours unless it's his family that is requesting those visiting hours. Otherwise, the prisoner has to somehow get the word out to people on the outside and give them his visiting hours on his own. Whereas the folks at Westmoreland, I think, just give out visiting hours to anybody that asks them about the visiting hours of their prisoners. So I'm wondering, is the Valley Street Jail just making it up as they go along, or are they able to set different rules for that kind of thing?
Mm.
Let's find out. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it's a great question. And really what, you know, the situation that Ian is highlighting here is something that's unique about New Hampshire in terms of the autonomous relationship or autonomous system that we have in corrections. The county corrections department is not in any way controlled by the state. The state is an entirely separate entity. Counties are owned and operated. The county jails are owned and operated by the constituents of each county. So they do not receive oversight or policy or funding from any other source than the constituents of that particular county. There's no reason, you know, that I know of why you would not be able to just generally tell the public what somebody's visiting hours are. And in fact, in the case of Ivar Jail, it's on our website. And the only dissatisfaction that the staff and I have about the Westmoreland arrangement is there are not enough visitation hours, because we have five booths. And it's very, very cumbersome in terms of overhead and manpower to go through visitation. So we're looking forward into getting into the new jail, where visitation will be virtually unlimited. That's our plan at this point in time, that we'll start visiting at like 8 o'clock in the morning, and it will go until late at night, 7 days a week. That's our plan, and hopefully nothing will get in the way of that. But I can't answer Ian with respect to why would another jail not provide that information. I don't know of any good reason why you couldn't.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
Yes, sir.
Good morning. You're on TalkBack.
Good morning. I have an article probably from about a month ago from the union leader about marijuana. And
yes.
I have a quote in there by Mr. Van Winkler. He's a member of a group called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And he says he supports legalization of all drugs. I just find it myself to be wrong that you're running the prison. I guess you're entitled to your opinion, but I just think to support this group, and I can't see any reason for anybody saying that all drugs should be legal. And there's also a quote in here from Lieutenant Shane Maxfield from the King Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
And he does not believe, he said he does not believe they ought to be legalized, and he thinks it's going to create a pure fantasy world where, you know, by legalizing it, it's going to eliminate all crime and everything else. So I just wanted to ask Mr. Winkler how he came to this thing and why he thinks this is it going to solve the problems? You're not going to get people in jail. The users are still stealing money and stealing cars and stuff to get money to buy drugs. So,
okay,
how's this going to change anything if we take away the prohibition against drugs?
All righty, well, you keep listening, and Mr. Van Winkler will answer your question.
I couldn't be more delighted for your question, quite frankly. And it is a very difficult thing to understand. I'm only sorry that you asked it like within a few minutes before the end of the show. It's a very comprehensive topic. We could probably do an entire show on this particular topic, but let me do my best to get to it for you. Law Enforcement Against Prohibition is an organization. It's a 501c3 nonprofit founded by former drug task detectives, Jack Cole, who was with the New Jersey State Police for many years undercover. We also have DEA agents, United States Marshal Service, a lot of correctional folks, a lot of police folks in our membership, who believe that the war on drugs that was really ramped up in the early 1970s is a miserably failed national policy. That's the bottom line. And these former police officers and detectives, most of them retired. I'm one of the few people still on active duty who is a LEAP member, believe that we should have a crime control or a crime management policy that seeks to reduce crime, reduce death, reduce disease, and reduce addiction. We see the use of drugs as more of a health problem than it is a criminal activity. And what we do with prohibition is we look at the alcohol prohibition era, 1920 to 1933, the great failed experiment, where as soon as prohibition of alcohol was put into play, All of the profits fell into Al Capone. The homicide rate significantly increased. The courts became clogged. Police corruption began to skyrocket. And all of the things that occurred with alcohol prohibition that were so, so wrong, egregiously wrong, that everybody called for an end to alcohol prohibition is the same thing that is going on with drugs. And what we have done is we've spent over $1 trillion trying to make sure that we can create a drug-free society, which, by the way, is the mission of the war on drugs, to create a drug-free society. And I can't find one single person who will even make believe that the $1 trillion and the 40-year effort has made a difference, because the drugs are just as available today as they always were. So it really becomes in our approach. We have over 300 million people in the United States. 114 million have admitted to using an illegal drug in their lifetime, and 34 million admit to using an illegal drug in the last 12 months. And I emphasize these are people who admitted in this study. There are a lot of people who may not have admitted it. And if we have 7 million people in jail right now, 2.7 behind bars, and 7 million in the correctional system, and 34 million using in the last 12 months, you're not going to arrest your way out of this issue. And this is a tip of the iceberg of what all of these detectives, police officers, judges, and prosecutors are seeing when they take a look at law enforcement against prohibition. Let's take a look at the global profitability of the illegal drug trade. It's estimated that it is a $500 billion a year profit industry. $500 billion. There is a Harvard economist, Jeff Myron, who actually did a study on the impact of the legalization of drugs and determined that the United States, through not spending money through prohibition efforts and through not trying to create this drug-free society, we could instantly save, and taxing some of this, we could save about $72 billion a year as we try to find money to fund all of the social programs that we don't have, that we talked about this morning. There's an opportunity. So there are some people who are optimistic that said using drugs to either the category of use, abuse, and addiction, and putting people in jail for any one of those categories is not going to help the use, abuse, or addiction. It hasn't for the last 40 years. And one of the last things I'll say before I open it up to any other questions or to comments by Cynthia is that the DEA just released that 75% of the gang violence in the United States is over illegal drug marketplace disputes. So, if you had...
You think that's going to stop just because you make it legal? You think these guys are going to stop fighting over distributing drugs?
Well...
Come to an end?
What happens...
The Ringe police chief in here, Michael Selecki.
Uh-huh.
He's a police chief.
He is.
That's right. And he says he's against the lifting... making them legal, and
sure.
There's a guy that's on the street every day, evidently, and probably worked his way up through his department.
Sure.
He's got a lieutenant from Keene, same thing.
Uh-huh.
And is the police chief's group in New Hampshire, have they ever taken a stand? Are they a member of LEAP?
No. The Police Chiefs Association is not a member of LEAP.
Are they misguided? They don't know what they're doing?
No, I don't think that they're misguided, and I think if you say they don't know what they're doing, that's your opinion.
No, I'm asking
I didn't say
you
that.
You think it because...
No, you said it. I didn't say
because
it.
Because you're making a supposition about them being legal, and it seems like the officers on the street, most of them feel... they should not be, and they want to prosecute people for having illegal drugs.
Well, we have been for 40 years, and it's not working. It's not working. Your tax dollars are going...
Working.
I'm sorry?
It's not working?
It's not working.
I'd rather have them in jail than have them on the street.
Wonderful. Then your taxes are going to go up, and
that's
we need
fine.
To build a bigger jail.
That's fine.
Great. You know what?
I'm in favor of it.
Well,
you can be in charge of a 500-bed unit. That's okay with me, because if they put the drug dealers away... they're not going to be selling to my grandkids.
That's awesome. You know, it really is awesome because you're the first person who has said, fine, go ahead and build it, blow up the crime control model, and that's great.
But if you make it legal,
mm-hmm.
don't you get rid of the drug dealers? Because they
of
can
course.
Go to the store and buy it, just like you go to the liquor store.
Of course, and then you tax it, you regulate it. Now you have a management policy.
Right.
What people don't understand is if you don't have... legalization, then you don't have control. And if you leave it in the hands of the illegal entity, there's no tax. When your children decide that they want to experiment from something, nobody's going to ask them for an ID. Nobody's going to care about the purity or the potency of the substance. Somebody who doesn't care about that 13-year-old girl is going to sell them a bag of contaminated substance that's likely to kill them. That's the policy that you currently have. And what law enforcement against prohibition is advocating is we need to protect our children in the same way that same reasons why we had to end alcohol prohibition. And you protect your children by having some regulation or control. Kids will tell you it's easier to get illegal drugs in their high school than it is beer or tobacco. Why do you think that is?
And I don't know, but...
Because you have control.
It's a conversation for another day. I guess we should continue.
Thanks for having me on the show, Cynthia.
Thank you
very
much for being here. This has been a great show.
Yeah, Clark, get a cigar ready for me, buddy.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks to our producer, Forrest Sundstrom, and thanks to all of you for letting us be part of your Saturday morning. Join us next week when our co-host will be Kendall Lane, King City Councilor, and our guest in the first hour will be State Senator Molly Kelly. I'm Cynthia George, and I have a great week, and stay warm.
So long.